invitation to speak. Yep, so today I'm going to be talking about how to do quantum computing with 3D surface codes. So just to motivate what we're going to be talking about today slightly, I'm sure everyone kind of, this is familiar to everyone, but quantum computers have the potential to outperform classical computers for certain well-defined tasks. But to build a quantum computer that can accomplish these things, we need to deal with the problems of decoherence and imperfect control. And to do that, we want to build some fault-tolerant quantum computer that can still do the right thing when some of the components fail. And the point, one of the points I want to address is the current best proposals we have of how to do this, which is kind of like 2D surface code architectures have requirements of hundreds of thousands of high-quality qubits, and this is many more qubits than can currently be built in the best kind of experimental systems. So we really want to try and bring down this overhead in terms of the number of qubits we need to use to do our fault-tolerant computation. And then, yeah, I'm going to be talking about topological codes. So these codes have a lot of desirable error correction properties. They've got a high error correction threshold, so the probability which you need to get your kind of gate errors below and all your component errors in your circuit, that probability is quite high for these codes. But then if you look at the kind of usual 2D topological codes, you've got some no-go theorems that severely limit what you can do with these codes. So there's a restriction on the kind of gates you can do, which they'll be classically simulable without using some kind of tricks like magic state distillation. So 3D surface codes are this a family of topological codes. They're just a generalization of the regular surface code you might be more familiar with to three spatial dimensions. And they're also closely related to color codes. So the 3D color codes have been quite well studied in the past because these codes have some nice properties, but maybe 3D surface codes haven't been looked at as much. But because of the relationship between them, you'd expect that it's possible that these 3D surface codes might inherit some of the properties that you have in these 3D color codes. So it's worth looking into them as well. Okay, so just to give an overview of what I'm going to be talking about, first of all, I'll give a bit of background so to make sure everyone's on the same page. And after that, I'll talk about this 3D surface code architecture. And that part of the talk will really be split into two bits. So first, I'm going to talk about this, how to get a transversal non-Clifford gate in these 3D surface codes. And then afterwards, I'm going to talk a bit about how you might want to do some decoding for 3D surface codes. And then at the end of the talk, if there's time, I'll talk a bit about the relationship between these surface codes and these color codes. Okay, so just to start from the beginning to make sure we're all on the same page. So we're going to be talking about stabilizer codes, which are these codes where you have an abelian subgroup of the Pauli group, which is describes the codes and all the code words. When you act with a member of the stabilizer group on them, they're invariant. And then to detect what errors have occurred, we measure the generators of the stabilizer. And from that gives us some information we can use to diagnose what errors have happened. So 3D surface code, we're going to define it in the following way. So we're just going to consider some kind of Euclidean 3D lattice, but with boundaries. So I'm going to use when I'm talking about a 3D surface code, I really mean a kind of Kitaev-style toric code, but with some boundaries. And the codes we're going to consider have these two types of boundaries, which are rough and smooth. And in the 2D picture, you might have seen these as people kind of slicing the lattice, so it's kind of spiky at one part and smooth at the other part. But I'm not going to define the boundaries like that. I'll define the boundaries in a few slides for a reason that might become clear. And we're going to consider codes like this where you have, so in this picture on the right there, there's the top and bottom boundaries are going to be the smooth boundaries, and then the ones on the sides are going to be the rough boundaries. And so these codes have this, we'll assign the elements of the lattice things in this way. So we're going to place qubits on the faces, then say our x checks, our x stabilizers are associated with the cells, and the z stabilizers associated with the edges. So what I mean by that is, given a cell, it's got an operator associated with it where you act with x on all the qubits on the faces of this cell. And similarly for an edge, you act with z on all the faces which have this edge in the face. And then this kind of code with these boundaries has one logical qubit and The logical operators look like this. So the Z operators are string-like, and they go from one of these smooth boundaries to the bottom one. And then the X operators are these membranes of operators with a boundary that kind of span the rest of the four boundaries. So I'm just going to define the boundaries like this, which is maybe non-standard, but so in the bulk of these codes, you're going to have each physical qubit's going to be acted upon non-trivially by two X-type stabilizer generators and three or more Z-type stabilizer generators. And I'm just going to say that a smooth boundary is one where the physical qubits on this boundary are acted upon by only one X stabilizer generator. So, and then the Z boundaries are defined similarly. And I don't know, the reason I want to do this is, so in the normal 2D code, you have this kind of thing, and you can define your rough and your smooth boundaries. They look like this. So this is somehow a rough boundary. You've sliced the lattice like this, and this is a smooth one. But we're going to define it in a bit of a more general way, because as you'll see in a moment, to make the boundaries work properly, we're going to kind of glue weight two stabilizers onto them, which means that this kind of picture doesn't work as well, because you're not kind of slicing through the lattice in a nice clean way, because you've got these additional operators that you have to use to make the boundaries do the right thing. And this means that this definition is easier to use. But that'll become clearer in a moment, hopefully. Yep, go on.
Can you define a boundary as basically a region where you can create, say, you know, a single Wendlandt excitation?
Yeah, so this is sort of doing that by the... It's a similar definition. But yeah, Alex is right. You can define a boundary. So if you look at this cube here, we can say this boundary here is a region where quasi-particles of this type, so this Z operator can be seen as you create this quasi-particle here, and then you move it through the lattice, and it can annihilate this boundary. So this boundary can be seen as a place where these kind of quasi-particles can condense. And similarly, on this boundary, you can have these kind of string-like quasi-particles that can condense. So you can see this operator is like a string-like thing that condenses and then spreads until it annihilates all the other boundaries. And that's another way you can define the boundaries, which is somehow equivalent to the way I did with the stabilizers.
So does this definition require that you have a regular graph? I mean, because it seems like you're assuming that each edge has each face has the same number of edges.
So the ones I'm going to consider do have this property, but I don't think you would need it in general. The first from the two X stabilizer generators comes from if you look at this code with in a different picture where you have qubits on the edges and X stabilizers on the vertices, each one is just by the nature of these edges, because they're not hyper edges, they're each involved with one X stabilizer, two X stabilizers, because that's the endpoint of the edge. But then when you cut that in half, it's only involved in one. I think you could define these boundaries in a similar way with for the Z-type stabilizer generators, where M is, I think, going to be bigger than three in the codes we're considering, because we want this property where the Z stabilizers are kind of form a boundary of a face for the structure of the membrane operators to work. So that's why it's going to have to be bigger than three, but I don't think it has to be regular necessarily.
What does the definition mean if faces have different number of vectors?
So I think, you're right. In terms of for the codes I'm going to consider, I'm going to say that M is some constant. And then I think if you want to define it more generally, you might want to talk about the definition where you say, this is where my X kind of quasi-particle can condense. But that definition somehow always seems a bit circular to me, because you say this is where this condenses, and so it's the boundary, and the boundary is where this thing condenses.
Well, we have like few different fusion rules, right? In the bulk?
Yeah.
In the boundary. So because in principle, you could kind of abstract out from the geometry, right?
So
require certain other, probably weaker sums.
Yeah, okay. So for this definition, we'll only consider codes with some regular structure. Then if you want to take this to a more general definition, you'll think about what happens to these quasi-particles at the boundary. I think that's probably fair to say. So what we're going to think about is this idea of a stack of 3D surface codes. And this kind of, well, this is maybe slightly strange, but what we're going to think about is you have some cube, and you've got three 3D codes kind of occupying the same space. So you're kind of, you take one, then you squash the other one and the other one into the same 3D space. And this is, it's so somehow, it's like when, it's like, it's the kind of similar to if you've got a stack of two 2D codes in 2D planes, but we're going to put them all together so we can do a so we can understand what's happening with the transversal gate quite easily. So if we do this kind of thing, we can describe the three lattices, the three surface codes with one, what we call this rectified picture lattice. So this is quite similar to in a 2D surface code. We've got, you've got, this is like the normal picture where the qubits are on the edges. This kind of operator here is a Z type stabilizer. So it acts on like Z, like that. And then you've also got these vertex operators, which act like this. And we can equivalently define this code like this. So we can define it on this different lattice where we have qubits instead on the vertices of some lattice. And then your X and your Z stabilizer generators just become different color faces. And what we're going to be doing in 3D is just the similar thing. So this kind of transformation where edges go to vertices, faces go to faces, vertices go to faces, we're going to use the same kind of transformation to map our three 3D lattices into a single 3D lattice. So maybe I'll just show you what it looks like. Yeah, OK. So what we can do with this lattice is we say that at each vertex, we're going to place our qubits. And then we've got stabilizers are associated with cells, and X stabilizers with cells, and Z stabilizers with faces. And the nice thing about this picture is it kind of allows us to view three different codes, but supported on the same lattice. And the easiest way to think about it is you imagine at each vertex, there are three physical qubits. And each of these three qubits is involved in a separate code. So there are three codes together sort of occupying the same physical space. And the first code, we have the X stabilizers on the green octahedra and then the Z stabilizers on the red-blue faces, which are just the square faces shared by red and blue cells. And similarly for the other codes. And this is what I mean when I say with this picture, we can sort of have this one lattice and it describes all three codes. And the interesting thing maybe about this is that in 2D, if we kind of want to take two surface code lattices and lay them on top of each other in this kind of way, it's quite easy to do. Because if we have this one again with qubits on these edges, if I want to, I can then just draw the dual lattice to this. And maybe it's slightly difficult to see, but you've got this structure here where this edge in the primal lattice and this edge in the dual lattice are occupying the same space. So we can do this kind of rectification kind of transformation again. But with this in 3D, if you want to kind of get three 3D lattices and combine them such that they have this property where you can kind of identify these edges in a coherent way, it's not as easy to work out how that's supposed to work, because you can't take the dual anymore because it won't work. So with this kind of lattice will kind of shows us how they should all fit together. And to give you a bit of an idea, so the green lattice here, which is the kind of this what I've called in the normal picture, it's a cubic surface code. So it'll look a bit like this. So in this picture, this is the standard, the kind of norm, usual Kitaev picture. This code has qubits on the faces, X checks on the cells, and Z checks on the edges. So that's one of the codes. And then the other two codes look more like this, where this is a 3D lattice of a rhombic dodecahedra, which, and again, this is a similar thing, qubits on the faces, X checks on the cells, and Z checks on the edges. And then the red code is like a translation of this code. And you can show that this, with these three lattices will fit together in exactly the right way, where you have three edges meeting at right angles at all these points, which means you can define this rectified lattice, which describes all three at the same time. Okay, if anything's unclear, please let me know. Right, and then this now is the kind of distance three code in this family of codes you define with boundaries. So, so here you can see it's a similar picture to the one on the last slide. These things here are something I was talking about earlier. So they're these weight two operators, which we've put here to make sure the boundaries have the right properties in terms of having these quasi-particles be able to condense on them. And if you have this kind of lattice, you can show that the three codes have a nice structure where the logical operators kind of look a bit like this. So. So one code will have its X here. The other one has it here, and the other one has it here. So they're kind of arranged at right angles in how the boundaries line up, which is quite useful for when we want to argue about the transversality of the control Z gate. Okay, so now we've kind of gone over the definition. I'll try and kind of persuade you that this picture that we've just built is actually useful. So if we want to, I'm just going to try and sketch a bit of the proof of why this control Z gate is transversal. And yeah, this is a gate that we're quite interested in because it's in the third level of the Clifford hierarchy. It's outside the Clifford group. So this gate plus Clifford gate groups, Clifford group gates will allow us to do universal quantum computation. So we can always write the encoded states of a CSS code in the following way. So this zero logical is just, so the bar just means it's a logical state, is a sum over, a superposition over every X, every member of the X, the stabilizer group with the X stabilizer group. So the stabilizers just have, which just contain identity and X operators acting on the all zero string. And you know this is a, this is correct because if you act with any Z stabilizer, you can just commute it through and it does nothing to the all zero. And if you act with an X stabilizer, it just kind of changes the order and the superposition, but all the terms stay the same. And then, yeah, with the one state, it's quite simple, you just act the X on that. And we're just going to write the computational basis states of the three codes in this kind of form. And I just want to emphasize that these vectors here, the 0 tensor n, these are, at each of these points, we're kind of, the ith point here and the ith point here and the ith point here are all the same vertex in this picture we were drawing earlier in the lattice, that's quite important. So once we've written the states in this form, what we need to do is we can just compute the action of this CCZ gate on these states and see what happens. So what I'm doing with this CCZ is I'm applying it at each vertex of our 3D lattice. And we know that the CCZ gate, that's going to give us, it does nothing unless all of the qubits are in the one state, in which case it gives a minus one phase. So what we're going to have at the point, at the coefficient here, the phase, is going to be minus one raised to this, which I'm just using this to denote the number of vertices, where there are these three qubits, where all three of these operators have acted non-trivially. All these operators have done X at this vertex, which means the whole thing's going to pick up a minus one phase there. And there are going to be a fair few vertices around the lattice where this has happened. And what we're really concerned about is the parity of this overlap for each combination of stabilizer generators. And this is where our picture comes in useful, because we know that the kind of green stabilizer X type things are associated with these green cells. The blue ones are the blue cells. Therefore, we know that they overlap on these green-blue faces shared between green and blue cells. But then we also know that these are exactly the objects that support the Z-stabilizers of the red code. So this means that these operators are all going to have even overlap with these faces, which means that the overlap of any kind of three terms like this is always going to be an even number, which means the phase is just going to be plus one. And then you can make similar arguments. So if we want to think about this state here, well, this time we want to think about the overlap of this, these kind of operators with these kind and with these kind. But it's just a kind of similar argument because we already know that these type of operators overlap on these green-blue faces, which correspond to Z-stabilizers in the red code. But we know that a stabilizer times logical operator is just another type of logic. That should have a bar in it, but it's just another logical operator representative. And this will commute with all the stabilizers. So again, this has a plus one phase. And I'm not going to go through all the different cases now, but there's kind of, you can make similar arguments using this lattice to argue that for every state apart from the 1-1-1 state, you get a plus one phase, and the 1-1-1, you get a minus one. And so this shows you that the gate does what you want it to. So I've kind of glossed over the fact that when you have boundaries, you need to be careful because sometimes things don't overlap on faces, they overlap on edges, but you can kind of work the argument through. Okay, cool. And now just to tell you about one way we could thought about using these codes. So if we know this code can do CCZ transversely, that's quite useful for us. We can prepare special magic states with it. So yeah, CCZ on a plus 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 state is a magic state. And if we prepare it in this kind of code here, we can then transfer it into this 2D surface code using some lattice surgery. So this is just a procedure where you measure, see these faded squares here, you measure kind of new stabilizers here. And then when you do some kind of measurements, and it means that you can basically teleport your information from one of from the states here, one by one, into this kind of 2D surface code architecture. And then once we've got our CCZ states in this 2D surface code architecture fault tolerantly, we can then just use this circuit to implement a CCZ gate on three qubits we want to do. So this is just like the state injection circuit for the CCZ gate. And so this is in this kind of, in this architecture idea, you've got this 3D surface code, which has kind of eliminated the need for magic state distillation, which is the subroutine in the 2D surface code architecture, which is to prepare these magic states, which you need to do universal computation. And in our kind of proposal, the need for that is gone. You can just produce these CCZ states quickly using your 3D surface code. So this is, we think that, I mean, we haven't got the enough data yet to kind of really estimate with numbers the overhead, but this is an idea as to why in some regimes, especially if you consider an architecture where kind of realizing 3D structures is less challenging, like ion traps, because you can do these gates where you couple a lot of qubits together, this proposal might have some advantages for these kind of systems. Okay. Right, so now if we go on to the kind of second part of the talk, so if we want to understand how well our architecture performs, we're going to need a decoder. And just to make it clear what I mean by this, there's an unfortunate kind of terminology collision with. So by a decoder, what I mean is a classical algorithm that you input syndrome information, so all the state outcomes of the stabilizer measurements, and it estimates the error that's happened. Not the kind of de-encoding circuit. So as I've said earlier, we have these kind of two types of errors in this code, where we've got these Z-type errors, so the syndrome information is just these kind of these points, and the errors are actually these strings. So here we see one terminating on this boundary, then here's two endpoints. And decoding these is kind of the same procedure you'd use in a 2D surface code. It's just a matching problem where you want to match up different excitations in the way such that you have the minimum energy required to do this matching. For these X errors, they're more interesting objects. So the syndrome information you get assuming perfect measurement, is a set of closed loops or loops like this, kind of terminated these boundaries. And there's a few things you can do to decode, to estimate what errors happened here. We're going to concentrate on a cellular automaton-based decoder. And these cellular automaton decoders are nice because they're very fast. You only need local information at the kind of local local neighborhood of your qubits to decide what to do. And also they have this property where they're single shot. And what I mean by that is, in the normal 2D surface code architecture, if you have measurement noise, you don't want to just try and do corrections, because you could quite easily cause a logical error. Because if you get a measurement error in the center of your lattice, you might want to pair that with a boundary, and that's done half a logical error, so you'd quite easily cause a logical error doing that. So what you do is you kind of gather syndrome information over kind of order distance rounds, and then you do a sort of 3D matching problem in time and space. But this is obviously an overhead. For every error correction thing, you have to get the kind of syndrome measurements. Whereas these kind of decoders work, you can just get one round of noisy syndrome measurement and then apply a correction and keep going like this. So they've got that advantage as well. Okay, so just to go over some previous work. So to emphasize, what I'm interested in is decoding these X-type errors with codes with boundaries. And that's a slightly more complicated problem than a code where there's periodic boundary conditions. But previous work has been done for using a kind of renormalization group based approach, and with these threshold probability values, and also using a Toom's rule, which is a cellular automaton kind of approach, similar to the one we're going to be using. But just to, both these decoders only work for the kind of standard cubic surface code. And I motivated earlier in the talk why we're interested in this slightly more complicated rhombic surface code. So we want a decoder that's flexible enough to handle both. So I'll just kind of recap, first of all, what the Toom's rule cellular automaton does. Because that understanding that makes it a lot easier to understand the sweep rule decoder we'll be talking about in a bit. So if we consider some square lattice where we've got qubits on the faces and Z-checks associated with the edges, and we have a cellular automaton on each face, and then if we have kind of syndrome, unsatisfied syndrome on the north and east edges, we just flip the face. So to show you what that happens, this lattice, this kind of error, this is the syndrome, then our decoder is just going to flip the faces like this and remove the error. So there has been some previous work generalizing this to 3D, but in that case, they just kind of applied the 2D version of the rule in kind of the three different planes, one at a time. And again, this Toom's rule is kind of defined for this square lattice, so it's not a general thing. Okay, so this is the generalization we're going to use. So this is work done by Alex. So you can have a kind of generalized Toom's rule, which is called a sweep rule. This decoder has an approvable threshold when you have perfect syndrome extraction. And yeah, for the 3D toric code, so I'm talking about a 3D toric code on a cubic lattice. There's the numeric evidence of robustness to measurement noise with a threshold of approximately 2%. Just to kind of explain what's going on. So this is quite similar to Toom's rule, but a bit different. So you're going to, instead of having your cellular automaton on the faces, you have your cellular automaton on each vertex. And then this is the simple version of the rule. So for each, consider each vertex separately. And for each vertex, you're going to flip a face which has this vertex as a member of that face if the following conditions hold. So the boundary of the face restricted to the neighborhood of this vertex matches the syndrome restricted to this neighborhood. So in this example, the boundary of the face is just shown by this blue outline. And then, so in the neighborhood of this vertex, it's just this edge and this edge. And this is exactly the same as the syndrome in the neighborhood of this vertex, because you've just got this edge and this edge. And also, we need this second point. So important point about this decoder is there's some kind of direction here. So this is, you can imagine this is pointing towards the center of this cube. And this is your sweep direction, which is sort of telling you in which direction you're trying to sweep your domain walls or your kind of syndrome loops to close them up. And so you need to have these, the non-zero syndrome edges that we've talked about above need to have a positive inner product with this sweep direction. So here, this is true because this sweep direction is going like this. So this one and this one has a positive inner product. So if you apply the sweep rule with this direction at this vertex, it would flip the face where the errors happened. So we can look at this in action. If you consider this cube with qubits on the faces and this error, so this has this syndrome. So what the sweep rule is going to do is it's going to see this face, this edge here, this vertex, let's consider this vertex. So it's going to look at the faces in turn. If it looks at this face, it's got the boundary of the face that in this neighborhood of this vertex is this edge and this edge. But this doesn't match the sweep, the syndrome in this vertex, because you've only got this edge here. But if you consider this face here, you do have this condition fulfilled where you've got the syndrome matching the boundary. So it would flip this face and this face here. And then similarly, if you consider this vertex, this face is going to be flipped, and this vertex, this face is going to be flipped. And what that's actually done overall to this code is apply a stabilizer. So that's, we account that as that's a good correction, because that's a logical identity. OK, so now I've explained briefly how that rule works. We're going to talk about extending it to a different lattice. So this rhombic dodecahedral lattice is slightly awkward because it has two types of vertex. So I've just labeled them here. You've got some of these vertices are kind of weight 8, and some of them are weight 4. And it just means that when you define the sweep rule on this lattice, you need to make sure that you've got a different rule for each vertex, which is kind of consistent with how your rule's defined. But it all, you can make it all work out. And I've done some numeric simulations to show that for this lattice with periodic boundary conditions, there seems to be a threshold at this kind of probability of 1.5%. And just to emphasize, this is a error model where we've got some kind of x errors distributed with this probability p, and then also we're flipping the syndrome with probability q, and we're just going to set p equals q. So this is a kind of toy error model of stochastic qubit noise and stochastic measurement errors. And to kind of investigate what the threshold does, what we're going to do is investigate the threshold as a function of the error correction round. And in each error correction round, the following happens. So we have some qubit errors with this probability. Then we extract the syndrome, and there's some syndrome noise as well. And then given that faulty syndrome information, we just apply the sweep rule as if we don't try and do anything about these measurement noise. You just apply the sweep rule naively. And then after n rounds, you're going to do a sort of readout thing, which we're applying the sweep rule with no errors, kind of order lattice size time. And this is kind of a similar thing. So if you're running this, you're running your error correction, your decoder, then at some point you measure all your qubits, and then you do kind of classical error correction on the outcomes to read out. And that's what this kind of final stage is doing. OK, so for some of the, so here's some of the data. So each of these is a threshold plot for different values of n. And each of these points is about 10,000 trials for each of these points. So what I want to show you is that, so here our error threshold is around here, about 3%-ish. And then it's moving here to about 1.7%. And then here we're seeing that the threshold is stabilizing around this value of 1.55. And this is the kind of behavior we want to see. You'd expect what we want to see is that the threshold will kind of, it will decrease as a function of n up to a certain point where it will stabilize. And this is the kind of behavior we want. So to show what's going on in a more a different kind of graph. So this is the threshold as a function of n versus the n, the number of error correction rounds, and then we fitted it to this this function where, so this is saying in the limit of large n, we're just going to go to this constant value. And so we've got quite a good fit here. So we've got some reasonable confidence that this code is behaving nicely, and there is a kind of threshold which exists as you go to n is n, take n to very large. Okay. Right. So now I just want to talk about what's going on with boundaries and this kind of rule. So let's consider the sweep rule on this 2D lattice with this kind of error. The problem is now that some of the error patterns won't be removed. So for example here, what the sweep rule doing on this lattice is actually going to behave exactly like Toom's rule. So it's going to move this. If it sees a northeast edge, it's going to flip the face. So the first round, it will remove this guy and this guy. But the problem is this one is now, it's never going to be removed by the sweep rule because you're never going to get this northeast edge kind of behavior. But this is simple enough to fix. All you need to do is just move the sweep rule. If you sweep from a different direction, let's say down here, then you're going to flip this edge like this, and then it will be stuck again. But then if you sweep from here, you could flip up like that, and you'd eventually remove the error. So here's Python's kind of simulation of what's going on. So it's showing you we're generating some errors and we're trying to sweep them away. And yeah, you can see, I think it should loop again. So the first part, we've got some errors and it's sweeping. Then eventually I turn the errors off and you just see what happens. So you see there are these kind of persistent configurations, but they eventually removed once the sweep direction cycles round to kind of the right direction for these things. And then just another interesting point is that for this decoder, there are these some kind of configurations like this which aren't actually removed by the sweep rule. But we can kind of correct for these, because if we have this configuration at the readout step, we can, once we kind of finish doing our sweep rule, we can remove this by, well, one thing you can, for this one, you just assume that there's errors here, 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 and up here. So you kind of move it and annihilate it like that. But we can do kind of more clever things like pairing up these kind of persistent configurations to remove them we're using a kind of minimum energy argument. And again, I did similar simulations for this time for a cubic lattice with these boundaries. And we did a similar thing where we have the threshold as a function of the number of error correction rounds. So this is, some similar plots. And we can see, again, the threshold is moving, but hopefully seems to be stabilizing as we go to larger values of n.
How likely is this persistent configuration?
I think it's also kind of suppressed in, so as far as I remember, when I did these simulations, you don't actually have to remove it at the end and you still get see these results. So I don't think it's that likely in the limit of larger codes, because you want a path the whole way through your lattice, right?
Because it may change the effective logical error, right? But it may not affect the value of the threshold.
Yeah, so that's the kind of, maybe the behavior I'd also expect is that the threshold should, because in the limit of large lattice sizes, the likelihood of this kind of error is going to still be very small and be exponentially suppressed. So it won't actually affect the threshold, but it will affect the performance of the code if you don't do anything about it. So one thing I have to point out with this data is that these are quite small codes, because this is the original Python implementation I wrote for this thing. And those aren't really big enough to have a lot of confidence in this data. So we need to go to larger lattice sizes. Because the problem with like even the d equals 15 here is that a lot of the qubits are on the boundary, really. So you're seeing a lot of boundary effects. So we need to go to much bigger lattices to be sure that we're seeing kind of a bulk behavior, not just some boundary thing. And then this is a similar plot to before. So we can see this fits slightly worse. But hopefully once we go to these larger lattices, we'll see some better behavior here and have some kind of threshold. And yeah, finally, so this is still work in progress. For the rhombic code I was talking about, the boundaries are even more, are just a bit more annoying than the cubic code. So we just, I'm still working out exactly how to define the rule for these boundaries so that it works and removes the errors. And I think that it's likely there'll also be these kind of persistent paths in this case, but hopefully it shouldn't be too problematic. And also another thing to mention, that it would be nice to get a proof that this this decoder works for kind of lattices, for both when you introduce boundaries and also when you introduce measurement errors. And it seems that it might be possible to prove this for when you have measurement errors or when you have boundaries, but when you have both, it might be a bit difficult. We might have to rely on the numerics, but hopefully in future we'll be able to have some nice numeric plots and some analytic proofs of showing that the thresholds exist. Okay, so I think I've got a bit of time left, so I'll just briefly talk about the link between surface codes and color codes, because it's another nice illustration of using this rectified picture. So color codes are this other family of topological stabilizer codes. We won't worry too much about the definition now, but the important thing I want to emphasize about these codes is that they're closely related to the surface codes. So various results kind of shown that these codes can be transformed into multiple copies of surface codes using local Clifford unitary, so they're sort of locally equivalent. And there's a nice result which says in 2D this transformation. So you can map two 2D surface codes into a 2D color code by concatenating the surface codes with this 422 error detecting code. And this is quite nice because it has a kind of geometric, very simple circuit which would accomplish this mapping. Because some of the early results kind of prove the existence of these circuits, but didn't. It's a local Clifford circuit, but you don't know exactly what it looks like. It could still be quite complex, but this is a very simple circuit. So what we did was we generalized this to 3D. So if you take three 3D surface codes defined on the lattice we were talking about earlier, and then you can concatenate them all with this 832. So this is 8 physical qubits, 3 logical qubits, and distance 2 error detecting code. And then this transformation maps you from your three 3D surface codes into a 3D color code. And this is quite a cool, I think it's quite an interesting interesting small example of how this mapping works between these code families. And you can have small enough examples that you could potentially realize it in the kind of near-term quantum proofs. Yeah.
For this concatenation, don't you need to shouldn't you treat this code as a subsystem code and fix the gauge qubits in a certain state to get the color code?
Which code is a subsystem code?
So the subsystem code is a small code.
I mean, so I'm going to choose the gauge where you've got the X on the cell and then the Z as your faces of the stabilizer. So yeah, I will choose a gauge. I'll just choose the one where it's the X cell and the Z faces, and then it'll work. And yeah, so this is just some more. Yeah, so that's what I was just saying. And yeah, this code is interesting because it's kind of the smallest 3D color code, so it has a transversal. That should be CCZ gate, actually. So it's got a transversal CCZ gate implemented by a T gate. And just finally, so we had our picture of this code. So what we're doing is at each of these points here, there are 3 physical qubits, and we're kind of going to encode them in this 8-qubit color code. And it's quite nice because this, when you what happens is just this. So this is, at each of the vertices of the previous figure, we've got this cube now. And what this has done geometrically is each of these cells has been truncated. So you've got these green octahedra, which go to green truncated octahedra. And I think that's quite a nice visual and way of understanding what's going on. Okay, so just to wrap up, in this talk I've kind of shown you this 3D surface code architecture and argued that it might have advantages over current state-of-the-art architectures. And I've also discussed generalizing this sweep rule decoder to codes which have boundaries. And then some open questions are, once we have got the numbers for this sweep rule decoder, then we can start to argue about, we can put numbers on the overhead of our code versus other codes. So it'd be interesting to see how it does compare to a kind of 2D surface code approach. And then another thing that might be quite interesting is, on an earlier slide, I showed that for the cubic 3D surface code, there's this renormalization group decoder, and it seemed to perform very well. Could we generalize this to our rhombic code? Because then we might be able to have a kind of better threshold and better performance. And finally, I'd just like to thank my collaborators. So my supervisor, Dan Brown at UCL, who I worked with on the kind of transversal CCZ stuff and the architecture stuff, and then Alex here at PI, who I've been working on with these kind of decoder results. Thank you.
So in the very beginning, you mentioned this result of Bravi and Kuni.
Yeah.
So because you're in 3D, does this... So you're not like recommending this theorem, no?
No, the theorem is loosely that in a d-dimensional topological code, you can realize transversal gates from the dth level. So we're going 3D to the third level.
Okay, Michael again.